This is the IBJ podcast for the week of May 23rd, 2021. I'm Leslie Weidenbinder in this week for Mason King. First, an apology about last week when we did not bring you a podcast due to a technical problem. But we're back this week to talk about the Endless Frontier Act, which was introduced this spring by Indiana Senator Todd Young and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The bill would invest some $110 billion over 5 years in scientific and technological innovation, including basic and advanced research, commercialization, and education and training programs in technology areas that are critical to national leadership. That includes $10 billion to create tech hubs across the U.S., focusing on areas outside of the traditional tech centers like Silicon Valley, Seattle, and Boston. Senator Young is on today's podcast to talk about the legislation. Then we talked with David Johnson, the president and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership, about what it could mean for Indiana. We'll start with Senator Young. And one note, after our chat, Senator Schumer announced he would expand and rename the legislation to the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. Here's our conversation with Senator Young. Senator Young, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Leslie, it's my privilege to be with you.
Tell me about the Endless Frontier Act.
So the Endless Frontier Act is America's effort to boldly invest in key technologies so that the United States of America, working with our allies and partners, will be able to win the 21st century. We propose investing significant resources in the National Science Foundation, as well as in the Department of Energy laboratories, to develop technologies like artificial intelligence and quantum computing and battery storage that will benefit all Americans, but may not otherwise be receiving private sector investment.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it takes government to step into this area?
Well, historically, what we have learned is that government needs to play the role of venture capitalist when you're making investments either in basic fundamental research or even in areas of applied research where the time horizon for payback is, say, 10 years or more, so a longer-term investment, and where the investment is more speculative. So in the case of an applied research, it would be you'd have to identify what problem you're trying to solve. And then your scientists and technologists would utilize existing research and technologies to apply what's already been developed and serve the needs of the greater good, whether those are military needs or to figure out how to allow us to grow more rapidly as a country and therefore all become more prosperous.
There is a ton of things to talk about in this,
yes.
This bill. But one thing I don't want to let get away is the fact that there's $10 billion here to support regional technology strategies and technology hubs. Tell me about why that was so important to you.
Well, this is really important to the people of Indiana, of course, because we have some key technology areas like advanced manufacturing, which will be funded in the proposal, and genomics also funded, battery storage, life sciences. There are a number of lanes, you might say, in which Indiana could swim in if it were to land a tech hub. But what tech hubs essentially do is they attract federal investment into a defined tech area, typically to an area that is adjacent to or attached to a university or universities. So what does this mean for regular Hoosiers? This means the attraction of venture capital around those universities, the spin-off of new startup companies, the relocation of existing companies into Indiana or the startup of new companies that find promise in some of the technological developments that might in the future occur in Indiana on account of this federal investment. It also it also would attract more students to Indiana's university system from our community college system, where various technology majors no doubt would be developed all the way up to our postdoctoral level. And we want to attract new talent. We want to retain talent. I want my four kiddos to stay in Indiana and dream about all the great jobs that they might have in the future.
Are you working with Indiana at all at this point to think about how the state lands one of these tech hubs, or is it too soon for that?
Oh, no. One of the advantages to being the author of this legislation, I say this unapologetically and without any guardedness, Leslie, is we have a running start. Right. I've worked with our legislative leaders to inform them that this legislation was coming through the pipeline. We've given them a high level education about conceptually what this legislation is all about. I know they're tracking it. The governor has certainly been dialed in, as has his team. And then folks at the IEDC and our various research universities, to say nothing of the private sector and the not-for-profit entities like BioCrossroads and the Central Indiana Community Partnership. They're all excited about this effort and poised to pitch for one of the tech hubs that will be funded in this competitive process that would be established through the Endless Frontier Act.
Are there benefits for communities who are not chosen as a tech hub under
this? Oh, absolutely. So, you know, the vast majority of the funding flows through either our national laboratories or through the National Science Foundation. Of course, the National Science Foundation for generations has been providing grants to our fine research universities like Indiana University, Notre Dame, Purdue University. You always run into problems when you begin mentioning them. Rose Holman, because there are so many in the state, right? And so we benefit in that respect just by putting more lead on target, as it were. The other way that the state of Indiana would definitely benefit is our funding to the tune of over $5 billion as the bill currently stands, for educating our Hoosiers and other Americans for these jobs of tomorrow that will involve interacting with and perhaps even developing the sort of technologies that we fund through the Endless Frontier Act.
Senator, why do you think that you have bipartisan support for this legislation?
Well, I have bipartisan support because though I'm a proud conservative Republican, I've worked very hard to cultivate the trust and amity and cordiality of my colleagues and hopefully earn their respect during my time of service. And that is the currency of legislative work. And so though I and Senator Schumer, who are the lead authors of the Endless Frontier Act, see many policy issues very differently. We have, determined that we can work constructively together on this. It's also an area, you know, that frankly ought to have broad bipartisan appeal. The American people, Republicans, Democrats, independents, and vegetarians alike understand that China is stealing our intellectual property. They're violating universal values and human rights that our country has always held dear. And they are quite intentionally trying to surpass the United States economically, and they have designs on militarily one day being an equal or power or even surpassing the power of the United States. So working through our partners and allies on an initiative like the Endless Frontier Act, we can avoid that future, and we will avoid that future just as we answered the call of duty after the Second World War and stood up this civilian scientific enterprise, which drove our economy, educated millions of Americans, made us more prosperous, and allowed us to lead the world in technological development.
Senator Young, I know you have a vote, so thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it.
I really appreciate your time. Be well.
Thanks to Senator Young for that conversation. We also talked with CICP's David Johnson, who wrote a viewpoint column in the May 14 issue of IBJ about the legislation and what it could mean for the Indy region. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Leslie, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you, and I'm really grateful that you folks are covering this. It's a very important piece of possibility for Indiana.
Well, you wrote a really interesting column for IBJ about the Endless Frontier Act, and in it, you sounded both hopeful and a little bit concerned about the future of Indy. Let's start with the hopeful. How do you think Indianapolis has set itself up to be able to take advantage of an opportunity like the one that Senator Young's legislation could provide?
Well, that legislation, as it continues to move through the legislative process, and it's doing really well on all fronts, it articulates several really top priorities for America to be fully competitive on the world stage. The specific target is national security, competitiveness with China, concerns that the United States is underinvested in research, both basic and applied. But it also focuses on the technologies that we need as a society, really, to advance the 21st century. And a number of that, there are 10 or 11, Leslie, I don't have the act here in front of me, but something less than a dozen principal technologies that the act would be specifically looking for centers of activity to advance. And the act has also a premise that it's time for some other parts of the country, besides the usual suspects on the East and West Coasts, to be involved in advancing that, not only because it's best to have many people in the country involved in something, but also because America's missing out if you don't include more of the best and the brightest that there are in the United States. And there are a number of parts of Heartland America, and we're definitely in one of them, that have a lot to bring to this party, and it's time that someone asked us. So that's really what I'm hopeful about in the act is that, you know, we have, or in the proposed legislation, we've got a really running chance at several of the areas that they talk about in there, in the biopharma and life sciences, biotech, genomics area, for sure, where we're definitely a leader. In advanced manufacturing and workplace-based technologies, we're the most manufacturing-intensive state in the country, and we wouldn't have the manufacturing assets we have unless there's a heck of a lot of technology enabling them, because otherwise they wouldn't be here. They'd be offshored or outsourced or automated in some way. And then there's also a suggestion in the act around some other advanced technologies that we're very good at, like battery technology, where the Battery Innovation Center at Crane, we've made some real strides in that with the national destination point. So I think there'd be a lot of ways we could be competitive. The act still is in, there were, I think, 200 different amendments filed to it when it was marked up in the Commerce Committee. It passed out 20-4, which is a good sign, but a lot of activity still on it. And how it ends up defining a region, how it ends up focusing on technologies and which ones, even how many centers the act ends up deciding would be optimal, all those things will be important in terms of our deciding what our best bets are. But we have a lot of different ones to try to make on it. And I think we'd be successful in something like that. I think we're exactly what the act has in mind.
So there's a ton of potential there. One of the things you talked about in the column, though, is that getting one of these kinds of regional hubs is really important because there are a few, I think you called them troubling headwinds for Central Indiana. Can you talk about those just a little bit?
Sure. One other thing, just moving into that part of it, something that is absolutely true and that doesn't get talked about enough when people talk about the great success stories in Boston, in San Diego, in San Francisco, in other parts of the United States with their tech centers. Those did not get started by accident, and they didn't just get started because there were oceans and mountains and, you know, great weather. They got started because of massive United States government investment in one way or another, either through government contracts, you know, the start of the space race. You know, every one of those regions has its own story. But getting technology at scale, building these sectors at scale, is difficult, it's expensive, and it takes a long time to do unless you get some help. And that's really what this act has in mind, is sort of jumpstarting some promising areas of the country and making them really promising by putting some direct investment into them. We can use that here. We are the most manufacturing intensive state of the period in the country. We are advanced in our technology in support of that manufacturing, but a lot of the data and the recent work that we've had done here by both the Brookings Institution and the American Enterprise Institute suggests that our technology investments are not keeping pace with what they need to in the 21st century, in part because I think people are trying to figure out where things are heading, where the opportunities are going to be, and the cost of keeping pace and making those investments is high. But we need to be doing a lot more and a lot better than that. Governor Holcomb has certainly recognized that already in a lot of his own programming in the state, including the manufacturing readiness grants, which are all about getting more technology and adoption and advancement. But you know, when your economy is as dependent as ours is on advanced industries, which are by definition technology-based industries and you know, manufacturing and logistics and life sciences and healthcare and energy, you got to keep up with the investment side of that. And there's some pretty good evidence that we have not been doing that as much as some of our neighbors and certainly as much as some other parts of the world. So this would help. It would give us all a really good rallying cry to do what we need to be doing anyway.
What does Central Indiana need to do to be ready to jump on this opportunity should the act pass?
We would need to be organized. We would also need to be pretty thoughtful about what our best competitive chances would be. This will be, if it passes in the way it's being talked about right now and amended right now, this would be a competitive program. There would be far more applicants than there will be winners of it. And we would be certainly going after one of the larger tech centers, one of the larger investments contemplated in the act. So it makes sense to look at what the competition is going to look like and for us to pick those things that we are especially competitive in to be sure that we, you know, really hold up well against that competition. There are some technologies in there, for example, chip manufacture, where, you know, we are not a leader in that area. And it would be great if we were, but we're not. So we need to be intentional about figuring out who the right group is to put this thing together or groups to put it together. The state, I think, would have to be very involved in helping any region do this. And I think the IEDC will be doing that. And then we'd have to pick the right technologies to go after and be able to show why we're competitive. But again, as I look at other parts of the country that are thinking about this and that people talk about as having good prospects, I like the odds we have a lot.
So it sounds like the IEDC could probably lead something like this. Who else should be involved?
Well, certainly we would need to have our research universities involved in this. It would again depend to some extent on which technologies we favored, but we as a state are very, very fortunate to have three R1 major research universities here, and there would be something for them to do in all of this. There is also, by the way, another part of the Endless Frontier Act that looks to put a massive amount of money, massive, into the National Science Foundation, like $100 billion into that, that would go to both basic and applied research grants that our universities could also benefit directly from through that companion program and likely could work together to put together additional proposals for engagement. So it's not just a one-shot opportunity and something like that. The universities would need to be involved. And then I think, you know, different organizations, like ours and others that are focused on these sectors and focused on and really pretty knowledgeable about what we have and how to talk about it would need to be at the table on that as well.
And have these conversations already started, even though the act is still under consideration?
Yeah, there have been discussions. Part of the basis for this act comes from a study that the Brookings Institution published, I think it was about 18 months ago, Leslie, called Growth Centers in America, that we actually took a look at while Brookings was in the process of drafting it, because they were very interested to know, and they talked to a couple of other Heartland centers as well, what we would think about the idea that there needed to be a direct federal investment policy around non-traditional technology hubs. We obviously thought it was a great idea. But it was really interesting research to look at and to see. And when they published that, it was cool to see the reception that it got. But again, this shows you how much we've lived in the last 18 months. When that study came out right at the end of 2019, I remember going to a meeting in Washington, D.C. that a number of localities were in. Brookings was in. There's some people from Capitol Hill in it talking about whether something like this would ever happen. And the feeling was, you know, it's a really good idea. And if a lot of these centers are really going to grow in the future, this is the shot in the arm they need. But come on, no one's going to put $10 billion into a new federal program. That's money that no one could even think about spending. Well, you get to today, and one of the big debates, and you'll see this when it goes, when the act goes to the House side, if it makes it that far, and they go, well, one of the big debates is this big enough? I mean, $10 billion is fine, but $80 billion would be better, or $100 billion. I mean, it's, you know, the sums that people are talking about right now are just, were just unimaginable before. And I think that may be one of the reasons it's gotten the early traction that it got, was that people really figured out a pretty tailored, responsible program that could really put a large, but not a ridiculously large amount of money to good use. So yeah, we've been talking about it. Our various industry sector initiatives have been in conversations about it. The IDC has certainly been keeping it in mind, and we're very fortunate that Senator Todd Young is our senator, the co-sponsor of the act, and has been a terrific colleague. He and his staff both throughout this entire process. We've been working with his staff for well over, you know, a year on this and talking about it.
David, thank you so much for talking to us about it. I feel like we're going to be checking back with you, hopefully when the bill passes, to find out what happens next.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. This bill may have the best chance of anything passing, any piece of major legislation passing on a bipartisan basis of anything on Capitol Hill right now. And part of what makes it fascinating, Leslie, is that everybody seems to be trying to keep it as quiet as possible so that it doesn't get overhyped and overpublicized. So it's very helpful to have a little attention paid to it, and just very grateful that you're doing that.
Well, thanks again. Have a great day.
Okay, you too, Leslie. Thank you.
Thanks again to Senator Young and David Johnson for talking with us about what was introduced as the Endless Frontier Act and now has been expanded and has become the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. If you're interested in learning more about innovation, you might want to pick up the next issue of IBJ, which comes out this Friday. It will be our annual innovation issue, and this year's theme is disruption. We'll have stories about how startups disrupt industries and therefore drive innovation, how the pandemic has forced changes that otherwise might have taken years to occur, and how last year's social unrest spurred the corporate community into action. You should also check out the most recent issue of IBJ, which features a story about a major provider of renewable energy that is planning a 200 megawatt solar farm on 1,660 acres in Boone County. Kirk Christian explains why some landowners there have agreed to lease property to the company, while others are concerned about the solar array's impact on property values. Plus, Leslie Bonilla writes about the quandary attorneys are facing as the Marion County courts prepare to move to a new criminal justice campus about 3 miles out of downtown. You can read these stories and more in the latest issue of IBJ, or check them out at ibj.com. Thanks for listening. Mason King will be back next week.